Page 153. John Guerin was worried. Some 20 players had now gone into a season unsigned since 72. Whether it was Messersmith or someone else, it was just a matter of time. Miller would get his test case, Guerin feared, and that would be the end of the reserve clause. "You don't test the crown jewels," he told the owners, urging them to negotiate changes before an arbiter imposed them. "The deal you make for yourself, no matter how onerous and unpleasant, is better than the deal someone makes for you." Finally, he had a like-minded PR chief, Ed Fitzgerald. The Milwaukee Brewers chairman came from one of the city's first families. His father, chairman of Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company, was prominent enough to have a Great Lakes ship named after him. Its sad fate was immortalized in song, "The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald." The son was called Young Ed, but was an impressive figure in his own right. Fitzgerald was 6'3", 250 pounds, and had led a marine detachment in Korea. Now he was the CEO of Cutler Hammer, an electronics firm, and was a tireless contributor to Milwaukee civic causes. Said an admiring John McHale, "Ed's the hardest working rich man I ever saw." Indeed, it was civic duty that originally drew him into baseball. In 1962, he was approached by the Milwaukee Braves ownership syndicate to join their board. They were mostly Chicago businessmen who said they wanted more local representation. Fitzgerald agreed to do it. "Little did I know," he said, "they were looking to get out." The Braves left for Atlanta in 1966, and Fitzgerald was left to catch the slings and arrows of the outraged locals. When an organization was formed to seek a new franchise, he joined it, quote, "to try to clear my good name." In 1970, Milwaukee landed the Brewers, and Fitzgerald became chairman. He came to chair the PRC the same way people come to run a winter charity ball, by default. From his work at Cutler Hammer, Fitzgerald knew about labor relations, a subject about which Major League Baseball was obviously in the dark. He looked on, appalled, during the 1972 strike. "It was a stupid argument which baseball finally lost," he said. "The players walked out, the owners caved in, and I wondered how we could have gotten caught in such a bad decision to force the issue." When Dick Meyer no longer wanted to head the PRC, Fitzgerald agreed to do it. He would soon learn exactly how bad decisions got made. That is a quote from Lords of the Realm, The Real History of Baseball, by John Hellyer. Its subtitle is not hyperbolic. It really digs into the behind-the-scenes workings of baseball. This book doesn't have any play-by-play or recaps of World Series past. What it does have is tales of greed, conspiracy, infighting, name-calling, hurt feelings, and lots of money. It deals with the relationships between owners, GMs, and players through strikes, labor negotiations, the ratification of free agency, collusion scandals, and pretty much every other part of baseball that doesn't happen on grass. I have no clue how this book flew under my radar for so long. It's tremendous. Hellyer takes what could easily be a boring topic, sports business, and weaves an almost perfect narrative. There are long descriptions and short stories and funny anecdotes, and through it all, Hellyer never ceases to lose focus or engagement. If you haven't read it, please do. If you have, read it again. It's a thick book, but it's an essential primer or refresher for anyone who wants to know how a baseball front office is ran. Baseball is a subject that lends itself perfectly to books, especially in the realm of sports. Just compare the baseball section at your local library to the football or basketball section. It's got a larger history, and so many aspects of the game are prime for narrative. But this does not mean that all baseball books are created equal. I've read some great ones, and some real stinkers. I was on a bad streak for a while, mainly because I was picking books based on subject rather than reputation. I made it through about 3 bad ones, and it turned me off the subject for a while. I picked up other nonfiction books, many I really enjoyed, and then, for some reason, I still can't remember, I bought Joe Posnanski's book, The Machine, about the 1975 Cincinnati Reds. If I had gotten sick of baseball books, this was my antidote. poor baseball books can still serve a purpose in that you'll probably walk away knowing at least a little more about the subject. But books like Lords of the Realm and The Machine take it so many steps further. They bring you into a time and place. They spell out other events that were happening in the world and put them in context. They make you feel like you had just finished an hours-long conversation with some of the most important people in the game. In the broadest and best ways, they help you understand the game better. Well, from the Harold Henry Schumacher Memorial Studios, temporarily relocated to Cleveland, Ohio, it's Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. It's all about books today, and after the news with Chris Swick, I talked to Tim Brown, the co-author of a biography about one of the most inspirational men in baseball. Then, other baseball writers from all walks of life chime in on their favorite books, and I mix base stealing and philosophy with the MVP of my heart. It's all coming up on Stealing Home. Let's play ball. We start every episode with a little bit of news as we check in on the goings-on in baseball. I'm joined by Chris Swick, writer for CBSSports.com, as well as host of the Eye on Baseball podcast. Chris, this time of the season is prime for overreaction, but there is a team I want to talk about, the Boston Red Sox. After a terrible 2012 season that saw the bringing in of a new manager, they are currently 12-4 and first place in the AL East. I know it's early, but the Red Sox really look like a different team this year. Is this a team that we can see compete for the AL East title?
I think it's a little too early to look at the first couple weeks of the season and start to project what we expect to happen going forward. I mean, you look at specifically the American League East right now, and Tampa Bay is under 500, Toronto's under 500. Those are two teams that a lot of people expected to contend during the year. So it's hard to draw a lot of conclusions based on that. Now, in Boston's case specifically, there's some positive signs that maybe say this is a team that might be a little bit better than some people have anticipated, because coming into this season, it was really tough to figure out what kind of team they were going to be. They made a couple signings. Some people thought maybe they overpaid for a few guys, but some of the core was still there, and they need what they needed coming into the year they've gotten so far. Jacoby Ellsbury has looked good. John Lester has returned to form. They're getting a really strong season thus far out of Clay Buchholz, and it looks like if he can figure things out and keep that up, he's going to be strong. So I do like what I've seen so far performance-wise out of some of their really questionable guys. I would throw Mike Napoli in there too. He had a hip injury in the offseason. That hasn't affected him yet. So I would say you can approach with cautiously optimistic, but I still have some hope in Tampa Bay and Toronto to come up there. And the Yankees have played well despite their injuries. So it's still going to be a really tough division. I don't know if I want to peg Boston as a playoff team just yet.
So we'll move on to Ryan Zimmerman, who is on the DL now with a strained hamstring. So the Washington Nationals have brought up third base prospect, a name prospect nerds will recognize easily, Anthony Rendon, who is set to take over Ryan Zimmerman's spot at third base, for the time being at least. Ryan Zimmerman obviously isn't going anywhere for the time being. He's signed, I believe, through the year 2020, or 2019 at least. And so Rendon's probably just going to do his 15 days and then go back down. But Is there anything we can expect from him as when he comes up? Is he going to impress people like a lot of prospect people think?
Rendon is a really interesting case because when he was drafted, he was considered by a lot of people to be the consensus number one player in that draft. Shoulder injury dropped him down to sixth, and the Nationals decided that this was the best chance to take a spot or the best spot to take a chance on him. The biggest question at the time was where is he going to play? Because Zimmerman was thought to be the future, and they eventually did sign him to a very long-term deal. With Zimmerman out right now, he has a chance, and it seems maybe like an aggressive promotion considering when he was drafted. The biggest question with Rendon is injuries. He's produced at every level when he's been healthy, but he's missed a ton of time over the past couple of seasons with injuries. Last year in particular, he didn't even have 200 plate appearances in the minors. So it's something to be concerned about. He's very raw, but based on what he's done when healthy, both in college and in the minors, he's performed very well. So it's a scenario worth watching, and it'll be good to see him play for a couple games. Whether he can stick in the majors is a different question right now, just based on the logjam that the team has with Zimmerman coming back and playing third, and with Adam LaRoche signed through next season. It's going to be difficult for Rendon to get playing time, but this is going to be an ongoing thing with him and the team in general, because even when LaRoche is gone, Zimmerman will still be there, and it looks like they may have to move him to first to accommodate Rendon. So that's going to be something to definitely watch in not only this season, but the next couple of years.
And turning our attention now to another prospect in the National League East. Well, maybe he can't quite be considered a prospect anymore. Mets pitcher Matt Harvey is, again, it's early in the season, but he is really showing some signs of potential. He's 4-0. He's averaging over a strikeout per 9 innings. He's allowing less than one base runner per inning. He's a guy. A lot of focus is still put on Zach Wheeler in the Mets minor league system, but Matt Harvey came up toward the end of last year and showed some real potential, posting a 2.73 ERA and a pretty manageable WHIP and getting still a lot of strikeouts. Is Matt Harvey a name that we're going to be hearing for a while, even though he's only logged, maybe 75 innings or thereabouts? Is he a guy that we're going to be hearing about when people bring up staff aces?
I think we are going to be hearing a lot about Matt Harvey in the years to come. I know that when he initially came up last season and even a little bit this year, the popular name thrown out when people watch Harvey pitch was Steven Strasburg. And your first instinct at that is to kind of laugh it off and say, all right, come on. I mean, Steven Strasburg was one of the greatest prospects, pitching prospects we've seen in a while. Obviously, that's translated. But it's all there with Harvey. I mean, this season in particular, his fastball has been explosive. He's getting a ton of swings and misses with the pitch, and that slider has also been a really dominant weapon. And I think, what you're seeing is against right-handers early on, he was getting by with only that two-pitch mix. He started to mix in his curve a little more. So I would say he's still learning, but obviously, based on what he's doing thus far and what we've seen, and just the level that those two pitches specifically are at, you have to be encouraged by that. And the fact that he's still young, incredibly young, and he's still learning to play this game at the major league level, I think that's a very encouraging start. And I know that they have Zach Wheeler down in the minors, and there's been some hype on him, but based on how well Harvey is pitched, I think at this point you have to consider him to be the better guy just based on what he's done in the majors.
Well, all these are certainly interesting stories that I'm looking forward to following throughout the season, as well as seeing lots more stories pop up throughout the many baseball games that have yet to be played. Hopefully, we can talk more about them at a later date. Chris Swick is a writer for CBSSports.com and also hosts the Eye on Baseball podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris underscore Swick. That's CWIK. Chris, thanks for joining us on Stealing Home.
Thank you very much, David. I'll talk to you soon.
Almost any baseball fan knows the story of Jim Abbott. He was a star at the University of Michigan, an Olympic gold medalist, a promising young pitcher for the Angels, and an owner of a no-hitter. He coincidentally happened to achieve all this without the aid of a right hand. His story is inspiring and certainly worth chronicling. So in 2012, he, along with my guest Tim Brown, published Imperfect, An Improbable Life. It's out now on paperback. Tim is a longtime baseball reporter and is currently a columnist for Yahoo Sports. Tim, thanks for joining me.
David, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We'll start from the beginning, I guess. I know that you were a beat writer based in the Los Angeles area, and you covered the Angels for a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about how you first got to meet Jim Abbott?
Absolutely. His rookie year, 1989, I was sort of a part-time baseball guy driving down to Anaheim and Dodger Stadium, but mostly Anaheim, and saw bits and pieces of Jim's experience from that year and the reaction that he got from the crowd. But what really caught my eye was the pregame. You would see these children and their parents, and very often these children would be handicapped or challenged in some way. And I remember then the following spring in 1990, became the regular beat guy covering the Angels. And just one afternoon, Jim was going out to do a challenger event where sort of a little league day where a lot of the kids were on crutches or in wheelchairs or were somehow otherwise challenged. And I remember looking down from the stands and looking at the parents and how it just seemed to me how desperate they were for that someone would let them know that their child was going to be okay. The most okay people at these games were these little kids. You know, they just didn't care. They were happy and having a great time and playing baseball, and I couldn't take my eyes off the parents. And I just thought that what an interesting sort of dynamic, the parents who want their children to be okay and the kids who are like, hey, I'm fine. And so that's when I think of Jim, particularly early on, he was 21, 22 at the time, that's what I think of him as, this guy who tied in, who allowed parents to believe that their young boys and girls were going to be okay.
And it seemed like at least the tone of the book was that he was kind of he didn't really want the spotlight on his disability. I mean, that was kind of something that he mentioned quite a bit. He wanted to be known as a pitcher and as a guy who worked really hard to get where he was, you know, disability or not. But there was, he mentions in the book a couple times about going out to meet these kids and how maybe sometimes he didn't want to do it, you know, if he was busy preparing for a game or, you know, maybe even playing cards in the clubhouse or something. There could have been times where he didn't want to go out and meet some of these families, but he always did it because whether he liked it or not, he was kind of, you know, the face, at least in sports, at least in baseball, for children like this.
Yes, and the other part of this, David, is that as reluctance a bad word, a lot of it was he just wanted to be viewed as the like the other 24 guys in the clubhouse, and every time he stood up and left, it was a reminder that he was different. It wasn't ever that he didn't want to help and things like that. It was just he wanted to be the same as everyone else. But by the time he got out to that dugout or into that hallway and saw this child and met the parents and, whether it was 5 minutes or 10 or 20, he was always so glad he did it again. It reminded him, you know, they would show up looking for inspiration, and it was Jim who would be inspired by them, by their attitude, by their excitement, by their just their sweetness, you know, by their challenge. Jim, while highly unusual for a major leaguer, Jim felt like, you know, this was just a minor inconvenience. But he'd walk back into that clubhouse feeling like, wow, you know, not look what I was able to do. It was more like, wow, that kid was pretty cool. That kid was pretty special. So and almost every time it worked the same way, David.
And I have to imagine that a lot of that compassion came from another big inspiration for him, his parents. He talks about his parents an awful lot in this book. And they seem to – I think that was part of his mentality too, when after a certain age, they just decided to, you know, for lack of a better term, treat him like a normal kid. You know, just let him be a kid and just let him grow and mature on his own. And I think that had a big influence on him and was certainly part of the way that he grew up and how he viewed his challenges, you know, throughout the course of his career.
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. And his mom and dad came from sort of different places on that, where his mom was very healing. She was, you know, she was very loving and she was the one who accepted it right away. His father, of course, accepted it, but he was a terrific athlete in Flint, you know, played all the major sports. They were 18 years old when Jim was born, and so obviously very young, just trying to figure out who they were, forget about having a child, and then on top of that, having a child who was going to need, you know, some help along the way. But his dad was more like, hey, you know, don't come in here crying about, you know, you can't get picked for a baseball team. You get out there and you figure out a way. And I think the two of them together, it worked really well. It wasn't exactly good cop, bad cop, but it went a long way toward that. And I think, you know, his dad was the one who threw the ball with him, and they figured out ways, you know, figured out how to ride a bike, figured out how to fish, figured out how to play a little baseball. His dad shows up with the first baseball glove, and it was years before Jim could figure out exactly how to maneuver that thing. But they were standing out there working on it, figuring it out, and, you know, Jim was a terrific athlete and big, strong, you know, could throw with his left arm and obviously, you know, became a quarterback on the football team and was just, you know, just a big, strong kid who happened to be missing a hand. And I think his parents, and I think it was also the entire community of Flint. There were no excuses in Flint. You showed up and you played or you didn't. And when Jim went to the junior high school to play basketball at night, they would push him to his right. You know, you're not going left on me. I know you can go left. You're going to have to prove to me you can go right. And there was no sympathy, certainly no empathy. And I think Jim got a lot out of that.
There's an interest. There's a section at the end of the book where you basically have a conversation with Jim, and you bring up an interesting point that I was thinking of while I was reading it. You basically, he could have published the first maybe two-thirds of this book a long time ago, because it's an incredible story about how, you know, he came up and how he worked through all the things he had to work through to become a major league pitcher, and it's really an inspiring story. But because he published it, you know, just recently, there's all this stuff about kind of the downside of his career, you know, losing miles per hour on his fastball, you know, losing the bite, you know, on his cutter. How different do you think the book would have been had he published it, you know, at the peak of his stardom, say, as opposed to, you know, in 2012?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, it's funny these days. I look at Roy Halladay. I look at Tim Lincecum, even to a degree, look at Josh Beckett, guys who have been very good, and I'm not putting Jim in those classes necessarily, but who were very effective and were, you know, Jim won 18 games one year, you know, could have won a Cy Young, you know, was throwing 240 innings and stuff. And suddenly, and I look at these guys and I see what they're going through, you know, I sort of get it because Jim was, he had fought so long and so hard to be recognized as just a pitcher, not the one-handed pitcher, not the, you know, quote-unquote one-armed pitcher, not the handicapped pitcher. And when he began to struggle, and it basically started with the trade to the Yankees, it was interesting because he was suddenly becoming recognized as being just a pitcher. When he was good, he was the one-handed pitcher. When he was bad, he was getting run out of New York by the back pages. And he always found that to be interesting. But, yeah, I think that Jim had some very dark moments when his career, when he lost his fastball, he wasn't effective, and he began to learn, you know, how important being a pitcher was to him, especially to him, because so much of who he had become and what he tried to be was overcoming this thing. And I think he only realized it through failure, that this was, and, you know, we had a lot of conversations, the disability, shield or sword, you know, did you actually wield this thing as a defense sort of thing or an offensive thing? Or did you feel like, you know, you used it to sort of fend things off? And I don't know if we ever got to the finish line on that, but those dark moments really, I think, allowed him to be the person that he always talked about being. That I'm just a guy. I'm just a pitcher. I'm just a guy out here. I happen to be missing a hand. Well, I don't think he had to walk that walk until he was struggling and then eventually failing. His career was done at 30, 31 years old, and he was now an ex-pitcher and had to figure out who he was and what he was.
Yeah, it's a lot of bravery that comes with it, because he certainly just could have published, you know, the book, you know, I had a rough childhood and I worked really hard and I became a major league pitcher, you know, the end. Good for me. But there was that whole, I mean, almost the second half of the book, or the last third of the book, where it was just, I mean, there's a lot of struggles, you know, going down to the minors, getting released a couple times. And it took, I wonder if that was something he was readily providing, or is that something maybe you had to draw out of him for that part of the book?
You know, Jim, you know, is the humility in him is unbelievable, and the honesty. And when we sat down, I didn't know what to expect, but, you know, I didn't know what he wanted exactly. And I found out very quickly that he wanted to be honest. He wanted to be a truthful account of his experiences. And he pulled no punches. I mean, there are some parts in this book where he really struggled to not so much reveal what was going on, but to live through it again. You know, he used the word, and I know that he has more perspective, but, you know, he really mourned the end of his career, grieved it, because, and I think a lot of these guys do, in their own little world. I mean, this is who they are. And it was really hard for him. You know, so much of who he was in his own eyes was tied up in wearing the uniform and competing and being with all these friends of his and these fellow competitors. And it was so hard the day that he decided to go home and left behind, you know, Chuck Finley and Mark Langston and Kirk McCaskill, and these guys who, they were so lucky they got to keep playing. And he had worked and fought so hard to play baseball, going back to when he was 7 and 8, to have someone again tell him, no, you're not good enough to play, was a very difficult period for him. And continue. I mean, I think he still, you know, I think he feels like he could have gone another, he can't figure out why there weren't another 10 years in there. So, and just to get back to your question, very honest, never reluctant to talk about it. Just, you know, we finding the words was what we were after.
His career was cut quite a bit short. Even back then, 30 was pretty young to be hanging up his spikes. He pitched, you know, all of course Little League and through high school, and then he played 3 years at Michigan. He did the Pan American Games and also the Olympics, and then was ridden pretty hard as a starter when he made the major leagues. Do you think that, I mean, maybe Jim Abbott just got wore out, or do you think there's something else about what happened to him at a young age?
A lot of theories, David. You know, I think the one I heard from his college coach talked a lot about how big he got. I don't know if, you know, he got into the league and he was sort of stringy, like a lot of guys, like a lot of 21-year-olds, like we all were at 2021. But, at, you know, over the next 5 or 6 years, he got into the weights, and he was very committed to keeping himself in shape, and he got big. I mean, this is a big man, big calves, big shoulders, and you know, he had that cutter, and he threw it so hard, and it was just so natural. And his college coach said, I think he just got too big. He got too strong. He got sort of bound up in his upper body, and he lost velocity because of that. There were other guys. Gene Michael was one who said he just threw so many cutters that it just wore his arm down. That it's not a natural pitch. You talk to other guys. Doug Rader scoffed at that, said it's the most natural pitch you can throw. You know, he was not injured. I will say that others mentioned that the lack of symmetry in his body, the left side of his body did so much work that maybe it just wore out, you know, that it had carried him as long as it could and couldn't anymore. And by the time he was in the mid to upper 80s with his fastball by the time he was done, and it just wasn't good enough anymore. And he never could develop a changeup. And part of the interesting part about that is that he could never hide his grip in a glove like most guys can. And so even off-speed pitches, you know, he threw a slider, he threw a bit of a curveball. Even those were tough because you had to change a grip, and the changeup is a drastically changed grip. And he just felt like I don't think he developed it because I think that he believed that people would see that it was coming.
Well, it may not have had the fairy tale ending, but it was still a very interesting and inspiring read that you and Jim put out. And I appreciate you coming on Stealing Home and talking to us about it.
David, thank you very much for having me. I mean, this is the most rewarding project I ever do in my life. I'll be more than happy with it. He's a wonderful guy, and it was an absolute joy to work on this with him.
Tim Brown is a columnist for Yahoo Sports, as well as the co-author of the autobiography of Jim Abbott, Imperfect, An Improbable Life. You can buy it at any major bookseller. On the subject of books, and rather than me spout off my favorites to you, I thought it would be good to get opinions from some of my favorite baseball people, so I did just that. I am first joined by Liz Rocher, writer for thegoodfight.com. That's fight with a PH. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you're a Phillies writer and a Phillies fan, so it seems natural that you picked a book about the Phillies. The title is The Rotation, A Season with the Phillies and the Greatest Pitching Staff Ever Assembled. It's a chronicle, so to speak, of the Phillies rotation of Roy Halladay, Cliff Lee, Cole Hamels, and Royo as well. Liz, besides the obvious Phillies connection, why do you like this book so much?
It's a really interesting account of things you don't hear every day. I mean, I love the Phillies. I write about the Phillies. I read about them all the time. And this book, you know, told me a lot of things I didn't know, like interesting tidbits that, you know, a writer wouldn't have reason to talk about when they're doing a, you know, a game story or something like that, you know, about things that happen in the clubhouse and, you know, details about the pitchers and, you know, I found the whole thing really interesting.
And it was written by two Phillies beat writers, Jim Salisbury and Todd Zielecki, who I imagine have an inside track on a lot of really interesting anecdotes from inside the clubhouse. Does something come to mind as one of your favorite stories from the book?
They talk a lot about Carlos Ruiz and Roy Halladay and the connection they have. And it's not so much one story, but there's a whole weaving theme through the whole thing about the two of them, and how well they work together. And they talk about Halliday and how he prepares for a game and, you know, what everybody does when they're around him on game day. And those are the I'm a huge Roy Halliday fan, and learning more about how he works, that was, I think, probably my favorite part of the whole book. You know, just learning how he got to be the way he is and why he does what he does.
And Roy Halliday would be a great addition to any roster, but not only, I mean, besides him, they also had three other really great pitchers. Is there any connection in the book as to how the Phillies were able to swing a deal for these guys to build such a formidable pitching staff?
Well, they talk about it in the beginning, the whole story of how the deal happened for Cliff Lee, which was kind of the last piece of that, the rotation. I'll always have incredible memories of that night, but it's from one angle. We're just getting drips and drabs of information. In the book, they really talk more about, what actually happened and why the deal was made and how the players continued to stay in touch, while Cliff Lee was sort of evaluating different teams and, the Phillies seemed out of it. I don't like Ruben Amaro very much, but I admire his audacity to be like, I think Cliff Lee is a realistic fourth pitcher for me to add, to my rotation. I think that's something we should do.
Do you see, at least in our lifetime, another starting rotation like this coming together? Or is this kind of a once in a lifetime thing?
That's a really good question. Considering the amount of money that teams have coming in, the amount of money they're willing to spend, I think it'll never be, replicated, but people will certainly try. You look at some young pitchers today and you wonder, 5-10 years, are they going to be as respected as someone like, Roy Halliday or Cliff Lee are now? And so maybe someday. And I most likely won't acknowledge it when it does happen.
Well, it's certainly an interesting story, Phillies fan or not. The name of the book, again, is The Rotation, A Season with the Phillies and the Greatest Pitching Staff Ever Assembled by Jim Salisbury and Todd Zielecki. And it comes recommended by Liz Rocher, a writer for thegoodfight.com. Of course, fight with a PH. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
I'm now joined by Patrick Dubuque, contributor at lookoutlanding.com, as well as Knotgrass. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
You picked a book called The Long Season by Jim Brosnan. A lot of people think that the book Ball 4 by Jim Boughton was kind of the first biographical sort of biographical recounting of a season through the eyes of a player, but it seems like that The Long Season came out quite a bit before Ball 4 and does a lot of the same stuff.
It does. Brosnan wrote The Long Season in 1959. He actually wrote a second book called Pennant Race in 1961, where the Reds, his team, actually won the National League and pennant, and then got swept by the Yankees. But Brosnan wrote a good 10 years before Boughton, and it's a very similar type of book in the sense that it's a running diary of a player. What's interesting is that Brosnan, like Boughton and like Hayhurst later, all were middle relievers and all kind of slightly eccentric, slightly off to the side of the major community of the clubhouse. And so they all had very different outlooks on what baseball was like.
Now, is that like a chicken and the egg sort of thing? Like, does being a middle reliever turn you into some sort of eccentric baseball player, or does being an eccentric person kind of make you best suited for a middle reliever?
Well, there's always Turk Wendell, but I think, which is, you know, eccentric middle relievers.
Right.
I think I was thinking about this, and I was thinking that I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that your everyday lineup plays every single day and expects to play every single day. You have your utility infielders, perhaps, who don't. But for the most part, your hitters play every day, and so they don't really have time off to be stopping and thinking about what they're doing. And starting pitchers tend to pitch every 5 days on a very regular schedule. And so you have these middle relievers who have to reflect on their performance, on the game, what they're doing. But they don't really know when they're going to need to apply whatever it is they've learned. And perhaps that causes that impending necessity, that never knowing when they'd have to play again, might factor in. Maybe not, but maybe that has something to do with how they process their experiences.
And this book obviously is filled with multiple anecdotes. Is there something that stands out to you as one of your favorite moments from the long season?
Well, I love Ball 4, and I love, you know, the bullpen gospels. But what I really appreciate about the long season is that Brosnan, for being an intellectual, for being this, he was called the professor, but he was very grounded. He had no pretensions about him. And the reason why he wanted to write the book was not to expose the league, but just to kind of create this human element. And so there's a passage very early on in the book in which Brosnan, who is locked up a spot, he's an above-average middle reliever. Nothing special, but certainly not in danger of losing his job. And he watches this 41-year-old Sal Magley, the barber. And Magley is in training camp, and he's had a good long career. And he basically paints the scene of Magley going out to throw his first appearance of spring training, and he's done. Just the first time he gets up on the mound, it's obvious that he doesn't have anything left. And it's this very sad kind of tortured experience of watching this other man who's been doing this thing for so long and having it just fail. And yet they're still talking to each other like ball players. So you have this veneer of the camaraderie, but then both players kind of know at the same time that was it, that there's this kind of miniature death going on in the clubhouse.
And it seems interesting with these kind of books, you know, this sort of trio, at least of these middle reliever authors, that it's not a story of triumph. It's not a story of you know, going against all the odds to make something of yourself. I mean, obviously, you know, any sports book is going to have a little bit of that, but it's mostly like, it mostly seems like I got to experience a really interesting thing for a while. I was lucky enough to do that, and here's kind of what happens. You know, here's what you don't get to see. And there's a little, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, of pulling back the curtain. There's a little, you know, expose, tint to it. But I think it seems to me, at least with, I can only speak for Ball 4, but it seems like it was a book that these guys would have liked to read if they weren't ball players.
Yeah, you know, it's funny with March Madness just finishing and one shining moment, and with all the other sports, particularly college basketball, football as well, all these sports are about a single moment, the triumph, that majestic point where the music swells and everything becomes right. And baseball isn't like that. And, you know, back at this point, it wasn't even about winning the championship. It was about winning the pennant. That was this triumph thing. And it's a 6-month process. And so you've got these players who are winning, you know, perhaps succeeding less than half the time. And the triumph isn't necessarily winning everything, but just surviving. And getting to the end and being content with what one's created. I find it to be a much more uplifting philosophy of life, that that it's not about having to succeed, that we only have one shot, and that our, you know, this Hemingway sense of grace under pressure in the moment, whether we succeed or not, you fail and you feel horrible and you blow the save and then you get up and start over again because one thing doesn't really matter.
Well, it certainly seems like an interesting read, and it's already in my wish list, and I can't wait to dig into it soon. The book, again, is called The Long Season by Jim Brosnan, and its recommendation comes from Patrick Dubuque, contributor to LookoutLanding.com, as well as NotGraphs. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for letting me read it again.
I'm joined now by Bill Parker, a designated columnist for SB Nation as well as co-founder of the Platoon Advantage. Bill, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And your choice for a baseball book was Opening Day, the story of Jackie Robinson's first season. This has a little bit of a tie-in to at least the movies when this episode is released, because the movie 42, the story of Jackie Robinson, was just released not too terribly long ago. Bill, what was the thing that drew you to this book the first time you read it?
I've kind of always been fascinated with Jackie Robinson. I saw the movie the day it came out, actually. But it's kind of a thing with me. And this was really the first book that kind of focused in on just that first season. I really like books in general that kind of cover one baseball season, because it's kind of a natural way for a book to be structured. I mean, there's so many, you know, stories and twists and turns in one baseball season that's always something that kind of appeals to me. And you know, what better subjects than Jackie Robinson's 1947 season? So it really, after the first 20 pages of introduction, and then there's an epilogue at the end, but really almost the entire thing is just this, you know, this one momentous season where Jackie Robinson, you know, became the first African-American player in the big league. So it's a really fascinating story.
And the author of this book, Jonathan Eig, also wrote a story, another book about a fabled baseball player, Lou Gehrig. I was wondering if there's anything about Ike's writing that helps the always great story of Jackie Robinson pop maybe a little bit more.
There really is, because it's a pretty broad, even though it focuses on just that one season, it's got a very broad base. It's not like it's the story of Jackie Robinson's relationship with Branch Rickey or just the players on the team. It really tells the entire story from you know, from April 15th through the end of the season, and you know, how the fans reacted. Talks a little bit about the other Larry Doby and the other black players that start to come into organized white baseball, and so really it kind of just covers the whole thing. And it's not a long book; it's about 280 pages. And so what Ike does that I think is really effective is tells this whole story, and he's got a very compact style, and so he can get it all in. You know, I'm sure that there's more to the story, but you don't feel like you're missing anything. You feel like you're getting the entire story, and you're reading this very rich, very broad story in, you know, not a terribly long book. So he's really effective with his prose, I guess, and it's an efficient, and it's a very it's a pretty easy read, but you really feel like you're taking a lot in.
Are there also interviews with some of Robinson's teammates or anything like that? Or does I kind of just take it all from a first person, or not? Or does I kind of just take it as a narrative, just telling a story? Or are there also other people's voices in this as well?
There are other voices, but it's woven into the story. Like, it's, you know, he could be telling a story and then say, you know, Ralph Branca said much later that, and then give you a quote about that. About that time period that he's talking about, or that event that he's talking about. So it's, you know, it's very well researched. He's got a whole bunch of footnotes in the back, and there are some direct quotes that, you know, maybe were given 30 or 40 years after the fact, but he really weaves it in. So it's just kind of part of the narrative flow of the story.
Well, it certainly seems, I mean, the story of Jackie Robinson is always a great one, and anytime you can get any more information on it is always a good thing. And it seems even more timely now with the release of the 42 movie. The book, again, is Opening Day, The Story of Jackie Robinson's First Season by Jonathan Eig, and it comes recommended by Bill Parker, a designated columnist for SB Nation and co-founder of The Platoon Advantage. You can find him on Twitter at Bill_TPA. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Next, I am joined by Robert J. Bauman, contributor to Knotgrass. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David.
And you brought up a book that I have to be honest, I hadn't ever heard of before. It's just simply called Baseball by Tom Clark. And when I Googled this book to find out a little bit more about it, the first article that came up was actually your review of it for Knotgrass. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about this book and what makes it so special for you.
Well, it's a book that was published. I have to look at the book to even tell you. I should have had this handy. It's a book that was published in 1976 by a guy named Tom Clark, and I knew him as a poet because I worked at a poetry bookstore, and I work there again now. And so I knew him as a poet, but he was also a sports writer, and he knew Mark Fidrich pretty well and wrote a biography. There's a new biography of Fidrich that just came out, but Clark wrote one years ago when Fidrich was still alive. And so this book is kind of it's a combination of a lot of different things. It's fully illustrated by paintings that Tom Clark himself did. He's also sort of a, I don't know if I'd call him an amateur painter, but I mean, I certainly like his paintings. And then they're of players, and then each player has a little piece of writing too, and it's stuff that's mostly found material that Tom Clark took from various interviews from newspapers or like the Sporting News or things like that from each of the players that he has a painting for. And you know, there's definitely a real poetic quality to it, but it's laid out in prose form, and so it's all players from like the 60s and 70s. So yeah, that's the basic rundown of it. There's the article that I wrote, the review of it, gives a lot more of the history, because I actually had a nice conversation via email with Tom Clark regarding the book and its publication and sort of what happened afterwards.
Can you tell us how you came about the book? Like, how did you discover this?
It's the place that I work is kind of amazing. It's a nonprofit organization. But part of the programming is a bookstore, mainly a poetry bookstore. And it doesn't get rid of, we don't have to return stock because we're not reliant on a profit in the bookstore to keep our doors open. We have other things that account for that. And so you end up finding a lot of gems, like a lot of books, and a lot of times at their original prices too. So, you know, like books from the 70s, 80s that you can still find. So this book, we had a number of copies of it on hand there, and it was still like $6.50, you know, from like when we first got it in probably like 1980 or something. And it's just been sitting there. And so, I mean, I love baseball, and it's titled Baseball, so obviously when I saw it, I couldn't help but pick it up, and was just sort of immediately charmed by it. It's just a really unique volume.
It certainly, yeah, it looks like an interesting take on the traditional sense of a baseball book with lots of very colorful illustrations and interesting poetry. The book is simply called Baseball, and it's by Tom Clark, and it comes recommended by Robert J. Bauman, contributor to Knotgrass. Robert, thanks for joining me.
Okay, great. Thanks, David.
I'm joined now by friend of the show, Mike Bates, who is a designated columnist for SB Nation, as well as the co-founder of Platoon Advantage and a contributor to NotGraphs. Mike, thanks for joining us again.
I'm happy to be here, David. Thanks.
And you brought up a book that skews quite a bit toward the younger crowd. It's a book by Matt Christopher called The Fox Steals Home. Now, Matt Christopher is a pretty prolific children's writer, especially in the world of baseball. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so Matt Christopher wrote books in the 60s, and mostly in the 60s and 70s that I... Well, 50s, 60s, and 70s that I was reading in the 80s. And my elementary school had just this huge section of Matt Christopher books. He stumbled upon, you know, a formula where he would write extremely young adult books, not young adult, extremely, you know, fifth to seventh grade books about baseball, and being a baseball fan, I just ate these up. The one book that I actually had that I didn't check out from the library was The Fox Steals Home. And it was, I read that five or six times within the course of 2 years, and I loved it. It wasn't a great book. It's certainly no The Kid Who Only Hit Homers, which is a Matt Christopher classic, or Catcher with a Glass Arm. It was really kind of a formative thing that I was reading. It's about a young guy whose name is Bobby Canfield, and his folks are splitting up, and spends a summer learning how to steal bases with his dad and his grandfather. And it kind of fit with my impression of myself as a baseball player, because I was never good at baseball, but I did like to see myself as like a Willie Bloomquist type guy who got gritty and dirty and stole bases, and that really resonated with me. That's the book that really you know, as much as Bill James did to really, and Rob Nyer did to stoke my curiosity and about baseball later in my life, and inspire me to delve deeper into the game's history. The Fox Steals Home and the other Matt Christopher books really kind of cemented just kind of how much I loved the game itself, and the joy that could come out of that.
And now I'm looking at some of these other books, The Kid Who Only Hit Homers, Return of the Home Run Kid, Miracle at the Plate, and they all seem to be about kind of the same age kid, somewhere in that late Little League. I don't know what they called it after that in your area. They called it Babe Ruth League where I grew up. But
The Kid Who Only Hit Homers, though, is great because it features the ghost of Babe Ruth. Who teaches this terrible baseball player, or who bestows on this terrible baseball player, Sylvester. I forget Sylvester's last name. It's really ridiculous. But he gives him the power to hit home runs, and he's really good for a while. Sylvester Codmire III.
Wow.
He bestows on him the power to only hit home runs. And then in the end, George Baruth, who's an old man that only young Sylvester can see or hear, leaves. And there's some question whether or not Sylvester is going to be able to keep up his exploits and remain the popular young man and player that he has become. And I don't want to ruin the novel for anybody, so I'm just going to leave it there. You'll have to read it yourself to see how young Sylvester does.
I've just purchased it on Amazon as you were talking, so I'm excited to
You're going to love it. it in the way that you could only love a book about a kid who only hits homers, featuring the ghost of Babe Ruth, who likes to hang out alone in parks with junior high kids.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, spookiness and creepiness aside, it certainly sounds like an interesting read. Is you know, for kids, if they're interested in the game of baseball, or at least a good way to get them interested in the game of baseball. The book, again, is called The Fox Steals Home by Matt Christopher, and it is recommended by Mike Bates, friend of the show, designated columnist for SB Nation, co-founder of the Platoon Advantage, and contributor to NotGraphs. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, David. Take care.
Those recommendations again come from Liz Rocher, Patrick Dubuque, Bill Parker, Robert J. Bauman, and Mike Bates. A big thanks to all of them for helping out. To end the show, I take a look at someone from the baseball world who, for reasons on the field or off, deserve a little love. It's the MVP of my heart. If you've taken any intro-level philosophy course, you have probably come across the work of René Descartes and his thoughts on dualism. Dualism is basically the idea that the natural world and the mental world exist separately, that things like love, sadness, humor, and despair don't exist in nature, only our minds. Furthermore, things in nature can have many meanings, as we as humans assign meaning, and each of us have different minds. Put that in your back pocket, and have a listen to this.
Cubs are set up to turn a double play, and Segura takes off, and he is going to be picked off. And Braun able to get to second base, but Segura is out. Wait a minute. He tagged Segura. Segura left the bag. And Segura's going to first.
Well, you can't swap places.
No, he absolutely cannot.
Well, they were both at second base, and the guy that originally had second base is going to be saved. Now, Braun's out. Now, Segura's at first base.
He can keep going backwards, can he? I mean, Braun's eliminated from the play at that point.
Right.
There's a good chance you've seen that clip. And if you haven't, it's still out there, so take a look. But the gist is that Brewers infielder Gene Segura stole second. Then he got picked off, trying to steal third, and in the process, Ryan Braun moved to second from first. Segura tried to go back to second, but Braun was already there, so Segura inexplicably went back to first. Braun was out since he technically passed the lead runner, but Segura was never actually tagged while not on a base, so he was safe. At first. Again. And if that wasn't enough, Segura again tried to steal second and got thrown out, ending an amazing base running display, I guess we'll call it. This is where dualism comes in. See, baseball isn't something that exists in nature. There are no biological rules that govern it. What's good and what's bad and what constitutes a run or an out all come from us, from the rules we impose. What Segura did was bad. He essentially was responsible for two outs after he had made it to first. That is not good baseball. But if it's so bad, why can't I stop watching it? The following is a quote from The Onion, so don't take it too seriously. I apologize for the blue language, but it seems appropriate. According to a new poll by the Pew Research Center, when reached for comment on this week, 93% of Americans responded, quote, okay, enough's enough here. You have seriously got to be kidding me with this week. With 84% saying, quote, is it Sunday yet? What? How in the hell are we only at Thursday? What the hell is going on? And 100% of Americans responding, no, no, go ahead. Just pile some more horrific on this hellish show of a week. Have at it. I'm not going to pretend to understand what the victims in Boston and West Texas or their families are feeling. I just know that this whole past week has been super crappy. When it's been a bad week globally, nationally, or even personally, I turn to baseball. Not as an escape. I'm not looking to veg out on the couch. That's what reality TV is for. I go to baseball for the same reason I always do. To find joy. And on weeks like this past one, any joy is welcome. While I might marvel at a home run or a great diving catch, the odd, weird, and ugly can be just as enjoyable, if not more. Because when the world seems full of so much bad, it's comforting to watch something bad and find it oh so good.
And the old saying is, you can't steal first.
You can't go backwards.
I think you just did.
And for helping me find good in the bad, Jean Segura is the MVP of my heart. That's it for this week's show. Another thank you to all my guests. For more information on the show or to get notes for this episode and all episodes past, you can go to stealinghome.org. My name's David Temple. We'll see you next time on Stealing Home.